This episode of the 9-8 Podcast is brought to you by Feedspot. Read your favorite blogs, podcasts, news websites, YouTube channels, and RSS feeds from one place with Feedspot. For more information, check out the link in the show notes below. And now on with the episode.
Listeners and Patreon subscribers to the 9-8 Podcast, the home of progressive and underground right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg. Every fortnight, I am joined by Mr. Dave Ellis. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Recording here on the road in undisclosed location, Western Australia.
What's with us being on the road of late?
I was going to say, I should take a photo of my setup here so you can see all the different wires and things that are required to get this thing to go tonight. It is
Oh, I know crazy. I know the feeling. My good old trusty Sennheiser HD280s that I've had for 12 years just shat themselves the other night. So I'm now running this janky as shit setup with my in-ear monitors running to an extender and then running underneath the desk and then up my back so I can hear people and all that sort of stuff when I'm doing stuff on the computer. So if you're listening, Sennheiser, send me out a new pair of headphones.
Anyway, podcasting problems aside, we should jump into a little bit of follow-up. And we have a piece of follow-up here from dear friend of the show, Joshua Batten, who says that Transatlantic Music is available on iTunes. So there you go. If you're looking for the back catalogue, you can find it there.
Doesn't surprise me, actually, that they're on iTunes. I think Portnoy and Morse are both very Apple-centric kind of people. So,
oh, totally.
It doesn't surprise me. Although it's a bit annoying that they're not on the other streaming services if they're going to be on that one.
Well, iTunes isn't really a streaming service. I mean, Apple have tried at various points in the years to kill off iTunes.
Oh, so this is actually iTunes, not like Apple Music.
Oh, yeah. No. This is iTunes. The original, the OG.
Right, okay. No, my bad then. My bad. Why not put it on Bandcamp then as well?
That probably comes into their record deals, I guess, with Inside Out Music or similar.
Yeah, good point.
Because we made that point in the last episode that Inside Out Music now owns Radiant Records, so they can't do the Bandcamp when you're on the major record label.
And they're going to come up a little bit later on in the show as well, Inside Out Music. We're going to be talking about a few different things. But is that everything for follow-up?
That is everything for follow-up, so we shall jump into the news. Now, you've got the first bit of news here, Dave. Why don't you tell us all about it?
Yeah, so this is really, really cool, although annoyed that it's not me personally that will benefit from this. But Carnival, back in Europe for the first time since 2015. They're going to be there next year. I was fortunate enough to see them Nottingham in 2015. And they were awesome, absolutely fucking fantastic. So they're doing the Regeneration Tour through Europe. A whole bunch of different dates. We'll put the dates in the show notes. You can check those out. To give you an idea, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Germany, the Czech Republic, France, Netherlands, and the UK are the countries where they're all going to be playing.
Ah, so it's one of those European, tours that stops just kind of east of the Czech Republic and ignores all of the Eastern European countries as well. So much like in the same way that we here in Australia complain about the fact that, you know, Australia really means the three big cities on the East Coast, European tours usually just mean Western Europe.
Exactly, exactly.
Maybe a little bit of, maybe a little bit of Central Europe as well, but definitely not Eastern Europe.
Oh, no. But it does look like a pretty good tour. It's about 20 dates or so. So it should be really, really good. Tickets are actually on sale right now. So if you're listening to this and you're in Europe and you either don't know who Carnival are or you do and you somehow miss this out, do yourself a favor, buy yourself a ticket. I've seen tickets online going for like 20 euros. God, to see these guys for 20 euros. I think when I was in the UK, I paid like £14 for the ticket, but that was 5 years ago. So definitely worth going and checking that one out. Now, the second piece of news that we've got is actually another piece of tour news. This is a big piece of tour news too. And Hoggy, you are the man that's going to be telling everyone about this one.
Yeah, so Toya Wilcox and Robert Fripp do these regular sort of Q&As on Toya's YouTube channel, and they kind of let it slip that there's an Australian and Japanese tour in the pipeline for King Crimson. Now, if this actually goes ahead for 2021, I'd be very, very surprised. I suspect it might be more like 2022, given all of the things that are currently going on in the world. But hey, they're actually coming here. Get excited, people.
Absolutely. I mean, I am admittedly not the biggest King Crimson fan, but there is no fucking way I'm missing that.
That doesn't excuse you from not coming.
Oh, absolutely.
Though.
There's no way that I will be missing this show. Absolutely not. It's King Crimson.
So there are no tour dates announced as yet. There are no cities that they have planned to come to. I dare say it's probably going to be mostly an East Coast tour. And like so many other things, it's all dependent on whether the Japanese leg of the tour goes ahead. If that goes ahead, then they probably come here.
Yeah. I actually did a little bit of digging on this afternoon and spoke to someone relatively close to the whole thing. And they mentioned that basically the entire thing was inked and done. And sorted out dates, the works, but before they announced COVID happened, so they just pushed everything back.
Aha.
So I think it's going to go ahead. Whether or not I agree with you, Hoggy, though, whether or not it's going to be this year, whether or not it's going to be, you know, next year, remains.
You mean next year or 2022?
Sorry, 2021 or 2022. I think we've all just written off 2020 as it never happened anyway. 2020's fake news, people. I agree with you. Whether or not it's actually going to go ahead in 2021 is a very, very different kettle of fish as to whether or not it's actually going to go ahead. It's a huge announcement because they've never toured here.
No.
Ever.
The Crimson Project have been here, but that wasn't Robert Fripp. That was other people and Adrian Belew and Tony Levin and Pat Mastelotto. Yep. That was a whole other thing. But
absolutely,
as someone who's seen King Crimson, I don't know, 8-9 times now, I don't even know. I'm telling you, if they're coming to anywhere vaguely near you, go and buy a goddamn ticket. This is not a show to be missed at all.
No, absolutely.
I'd like to think they'd play the Sydney Opera House, and if they are, that'd be fantastic.
That would be such a good show.
Because they always play theatres. I mean, this is a theatre gig.
It's probably likely in Sydney, it might likely be the State Theatre.
You think that might be a bit too small?
Well, okay, so here's the thing, right? It's King Crimson. It's the first time they have ever been to Australia.
Could be the Enmore.
I mean, it's not going to be, let's be honest, it's not going to be the Horden Pavilion. It's just not going to happen
No, but that's not a theatre gig.
They're not big enough to do like an Acer Arena or any of that sort of Sydney Olympic Park stuff.
No, they don't do arenas. They don't do arenas at all. It's going to be a theatre gig. It just depends on which one. So, like, you've got the Enmore, the Opera House, or the State Theatre.
Yeah, they're the three, realistically. Enmore is the best live room in Sydney. I've said this numerous times. Whether or not the Opera House will be ready is another thing. Oh, you've also got the ICC, but We don't talk about the ICC.
No, we don't talk about the ICC.
And then you've got the State Theatre as well. State Theatre is apparently pretty good. I've seen one show
stuff in the State. I've seen classical gigs in the State Theatre. It's pretty good.
Okay.
The sound is very good. But that's what we're optimizing for here. We're optimizing for a good sounding room. King Crimson don't give a flying toss about like size of gig or whatever, as long as the sound's got to be good. It's got to be a good sounding room.
It might be the Enmore.
Given that Stephen Wilson has played at the Enmore. Yeah, I was going to say, given that Stephen Wilson has played at the Enmore, I'd probably back the Enmore. Melbourne, it's going to be the Palais. That's not even up for debate.
But I think I'm with you. Enmore Theatre is probably the most likely outcome.
Yeah. Presupposing that it goes ahead at all.
Yes. Well, presupposing that anything goes ahead next year. I mean, we're still so far up in we don't know what's happening land.
Well, it all depends on how quickly other larger countries currently being occupied by lame dark orange morons that when they get their shit together.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the crazy thing, isn't it? I mean, we're ostensibly COVID-free here in Australia now.
To a first approximation, yes.
Yeah. I mean, except for Adelaide. I mean, Adelaide's having a bit of a rough time at the moment. We're with you, Adelaide. Apologise. But you know what? The Victorians can do it. I'm sure you guys can.
Exactly. However, certain other countries run by, again, lame duck orange morons have got hundreds of thousands of new cases per day.
Yeah. It's...
And certain other large empire-like countries run by, you know, clowns also have thousands and thousands of new cases a day. So those are like the two major hubs for all where all the big tours are coming from. So if those two countries continue to be like these COVID-19 hot zones, I don't see anybody going anywhere.
No, I agree with you. But it is definitely something to watch. We're extremely excited about. I'm extremely excited about it. But we will see what happens in the next little while. But I think that's about all the news we were really going to touch on for this episode. There's been a few things that have sort of happened, but a lot of stuff that's not really major news, and probably a lot of you have probably heard a lot of the minor stuff. So we're probably just going to drop into a new music section here. Hoggy, what are we talking about?
So we had an album recommended to us by a listener from the show, Paul Summer. Thank you very much for your recommendation. The album was by a band called Dirt Poor Robins, and the album was called Dead Horse. Now, what did you think about this album, Dave?
I'm going to preface this by saying all music, no matter how good or bad it is always instrumental in forming your musical opinion. That being said, I really didn't like this album. I didn't particularly grab me. It kind of meandered a lot. Don't get me wrong. Nowhere near as bad as that person whose name I can't remember.
You're talking about a Scott Walker record again, aren't you?
Scott Walker, yes.
That's going to be like your touchstone for bad records for the rest of the run of this show.
For a long time, yeah.
You know, a record, you may not like a record, but it won't be as bad as Scott Walker.
That's exactly it. So, look, it wasn't terrible. I just didn't like it. And I don't know, like it sort of, for me, it didn't really seem like it knew what it wanted to be. It was sort of like this country Americana noir kind of thing, and then they were trying to like ram some jazz voicings into a lot of the chords and so on and so forth, and it just didn't really work, in my opinion.
The thing that it reminded me more of than anything else is like, I don't know why, and there's probably something musically or stylistically there, but just like East Coast American indie rock. There's something in that sound that just reminds me of like East Coast American indie rock kind of hipster sort of thing. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was the sound of the vocals or, like you said, choices of chords or... the sort of kind of weird sort of retro feel to some of the songs as well. There's something about it that just reminded me of East Coast American indie rock. And there is some East Coast American indie rock that I particularly like. I am a particularly big fan of a band called the Magnetic Fields, which do this style of music very... You know the Magnetic Fields?
I do, yes.
Excellent. They are very good at it.
They are.
Stephen Merritt is an absolute superstar as a songwriter. This, on the other hand, was off in a slightly different place, and yeah, I couldn't quite gel with it. There were some interesting melodies going on, and there appears to be this large overarching story to it that I didn't quite wrap my head around.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? It, it kind of... There was a bigger story, I think, to be had, but I didn't care enough to find out.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, just meh, really? Okay. That being said, if anyone has a an album recommendation or anything like that, please do send it through because we do listen to them. We always listen to stuff that people send through to us and, you know, we are both wanting new music to listen to and all that sort of stuff all the time. So don't let this put you off either.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, hell, it was like something that got sent. I mean, moving on to our next piece of new music, it was another piece of new music that got us into probably one of our most favorite bands that we've discovered this year, which is the music of Malcolm Galloway. He's just released another one of his albums. This isn't the Hats Off Gentlemen, It's Adequate album that we referenced last week. This is something else entirely. This is one of his classical minimalist albums called Wasp 76B. It's available on the Bandcamp. We will chuck a link to it into the show notes. I think I mentioned this last time, but I really found an affinity with his classical minimalist music a couple of years ago when I was working a Dreadful Dead, horrible cube farm job. And I just basically spent 12 hours in a box with my headphones on doing work and pretending not to be noticed by the bosses. So... that music was a real help to me then. So if you like that kind of music and you use that sort of thing when you're, I don't know, at the gym or at work or whatever, go and check it out. It's really good.
I agree with you. I think it's amazing. And his work is amazing as well. So, you know, definitely something to check this through. Now don't forget as well, there is a very large playlist that you can find on Spotify. If Spotify is your thing, of every single prog release available on Spotify that has been released this year. If you do want to access that, jump on and just search 2020 new prog releases. You'll see there's one in there called By David Ellis. Like it'll say By David Ellis, playlist by David Ellis. And that is every single new prog song or prog album that has come out this year so far to this date as a date of recording. So far, we're up to nearly 3,900 songs or 364 hours of music. And I just want to take a few seconds here just to say, Spotify, if it ain't broke, don't fucking fix it.
It's always broken and they always need to fix it. Otherwise, how would they ever know that they change anything?
My God, it appears Spotify has just changed the way its app and its desktop app actually works. So now every single time you add a song to a playlist, or for example, if you add an album to a large playlist that say you've been curating all year, like the one I have, it now goes to the top of the playlist instead of the bottom of the playlist where it has been going the entire year. And there's no option to resort it. There's no option to do anything with it.
Are you sure you just haven't reached some like arbitrary limit that a playlist can exist on Spotify and you've broken it somehow?
That's what I thought first. At first, I was like, oh, have I breached a limit or something?
Because I can't think of many other people that have managed to make a playlist that's like 3,900 songs long.
Sure, and I agree with you. So I looked up the playlist limit and it's 10,000. So I was like, okay, well, this doesn't really seem to make sort of any kind of sense as to why on earth there would be any kind of a change to what has what has occurred. But they have changed it, and it's very irritating. And so if you do look up the playlist, a couple of the songs, and probably for the next little while, the songs may be out of order because they're actually in release order. Or they were in release order anyway. So if you do look it up and they're out of order, I apologize.
So that reaches the end of our music/news section. Now we're going to move on to our main topic, which is our Q&A. We have received quite many questions from many of our listeners out there, so thank you very much for sending them in.
Absolutely. We've been threatening to do this for a while. So
We have. So we're going to kick it off with a very, very dear listener to ours and one of our Patreon subscribers, Ben, over at Australian Hunger. Thank you very much for sending through a very long list of questions here. So we'll kick it off at the top with his first question, which is, I get angry about music. You get angry about music. Do you think that's healthy? To which I say, yes, because it's a hell of a lot better than getting angry about just about anything else in the world.
Not that that stops us.
Nope, not at all.
Yes, look, I think it's healthy depending on how the anger is placed, right? So if you're getting angry because someone has got a more famous song than you, that's not healthy. That's just bullshit, you know what I mean? The question is, how do you learn from that, and how do you get better? Like, for example, this last week in Australia, we had the Arias here, which is kind of like our discount version of the Grammys. And a band from Australia called King Gizzard.
I'm sure that's how they love to market the Arias too, by the way. The Arias, a discount version of the American Grammys.
Well, everything just about is. Now, there's a band from Australia called King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, I think is how you pronounce it, from memory, or the Lizard or whatever it is. They took out somehow Best Metal Performance, Best Hard Rock Metal Performance, or something.
1990 called. Jethro Tull would like to hand back their best heavy metal record.
100%. And this was the thing, right? So I actually had Dan over on Saturday night, and we were talking about it. And when he arrived at the door, he's like, "Hey, things, man." I said, "Good." And I said, "Look, I'm going to get this out of the way really early. I'm so sorry that you lost that. That was bullshit." And he was like, "No, it's okay. Like, I love the guys in there and everything." And
look, what I was going to say was, it's better if they win next year, because then it gives them their acceptance speech already made. It's like, thank you to King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard for not putting a fucking record out this year. Like Metallica did when they won their Grammy the next year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's healthy to get angry about maybe the institutions of music and the music industry as a whole, but to get angry about music itself, I don't know. As I said before, I think there's a lot of different music out there, and I think there's a lot to be either angry or happy or sad about it. And some music can genuinely make you angry or scared or anxious or what have you, just by what's going on. But I think there are things that we should get angry about in the music industry, like how it's set up, like the manipulation of it. You know, we should probably get angry at how happy clappers use it in churches.
That's exactly
to suck
what
money
I was going
out of people.
To say.
You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot more things to be angry about.
What I was going to say was, I don't think we actually get angry about the music in general. We get angry at the music industry. Yes. We get angry at the music scene. Yes. We get angry at the music fans. We do plenty of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't think we've ever actually got angry at the music itself.
Mm.
Disappointed, yeah, but I don't think we've ever gotten angry.
Then again, maybe we have. If you think we've been too angry, by all means, please send us an email and tell us when and why we have been, because I'd actually really like to know.
Yeah, chances are you probably know our episodes better than we do. That's almost certainly. Anyway, the next question from Ben was, is there any direction you would like to see prog take?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is. A meaningful step in the right direction is the answer that I'm going to give to that.
And what is the right direction?
We've covered this actually over the last couple of episodes, as it happens. The amount of people who write a 14-minute song because they can write a 14-minute song.
Right. This is the transatlantic approach to songwriting. They make it long for the sake of making it long, just about.
Correct. Yeah. You know, rather than making a song that suits the song and is purposeful and is great, you know what I mean? Like, rather than any of that, I would like to see prog go back to doing what it did best, which was actually making everything serve the song and serve the album. And, you know, it's a really interesting thing. We've spoken about it on the show a few times, where technical limitations back in the day actually made people think. Now we don't really have technical limitations insofar as song lengths and, you know, album lengths and all that sort of stuff is concerned. And, you know, studio time and all that sort of stuff. And yet there's a lot of, you know, there's still a lot of crap out there that really probably should be snipped. And I think that's partly due to a couple of different reasons. The first reason is, as I mentioned, no technical limitations on, well, you only get X amount of time, 72 minutes on a CD or what have you. So that's as long as the album can be. The second reason is a lot of people are producing at home in their bedrooms and so on and so forth, and they don't have anyone there to say, no, that's shit. Right? I'm sorry.
I was just about to say exactly the same thing. It's like pretty much everything is self-produced. Everybody thinks everything they do is great and ends up on the record. I think that's been one of the main criticisms for a number of, if not all of the Dream Theater records in the post-Scenes of Memory era.
Yep.
It's like they've all been self-produced and there's been a tremendous amount of bloat on a bunch of those records because they produce it themselves and there's no one around to kind of say, well, up until very recently, there's been no one around to kind of say no. Thomas Weber at Inside Out Music sort of kind of filled a bit of that role on the last record, but not in any sort of official capacity. And he's doing it almost as like a fan rather than like any sort of producer type arrangement.
I mean, the way I look at it is this: if Paul McCartney needs a producer, you do.
Yeah, but have you heard the story about what he did to was it Hugh Padgham? I think they worked on a record together. Like, Hugh Padgham was a producer in the 80s. And he tried to give Paul McCartney some direction on something. And Paul McCartney hit back with the famous line of, how many top 40 songs have you made, mate? And he just sort of ended up in this situation where, you know, he can't be told because he's like Paul McCartney and I make number one hits for fun. I made number one hits for fun with the Beatles and shit like that. So,
look, he is extremely prolific, but I mean, he still works with the producer.
That's true. And his relationship with these producers are probably a hell of a lot different than they were back in like the 80s.
More than likely. And you don't know whether or not that was like Hugh, for example, if indeed that was who it was. I don't know. I don't know the story. But you don't know whether or not the guy was being like, yo, I reckon it needs more cowbell. You know what I mean? And McCartney just got the shits with it. You don't know the full backstory of the whole thing and whether or not he was just trying to, like, you know, cement his own thing in there because he was working with Paul McCartney. So who knows? Yeah, I think that's a big thing. You know, what direction would I like to see prog take? I would like to see prog take going back to limiting themselves, because I think with limitations, you find workarounds and you find ways to do things that you're not supposed to be able to do within that time frame. And that's when, if there's no envelope, you can't push it, right?
Yep.
So there has to be an envelope there, whatever the envelope may be.
Yep.
So I don't know. That's me. What do you think? I mean, sorry, I've blabbed, but what do you think?
I mean, a direction I would like to see prog take, I would like to see a little bit more experimentation with the instruments. I don't think it's too far out of the box to say that we've pretty much pushed the guitar to like the edge of where it can possibly go.
Mm-hmm.
So what if we tried with a few other instruments? Maybe some interesting other, I'm not going to suggest that, like, you know, a bunch of dudes in America or Australia pick up like other instruments from around the world, but maybe there's different sounds that they can incorporate from other musical styles rather than just like the blues and like usual kind of Western music style.
Or even maybe experimenting with like microtonals. Microtonings and so on and so forth on guitar, and implementing Greek styles, so with like the bouzouki and so on and so forth in these things, so instead of having semitones, why not have semitones on guitars and so on and so forth, and have really weird interesting phrasings.
It's
a good point.
I mean, effectively, that's what King Crimson's been doing with like the new standard guitar tuning Robert Fripp's been using for the last 30 some odd years. Instead of it being the standard tuning, it's a different tuning, which means all your useful, like usual blues licks go out the window and you have to reapproach the way you play guitar.
Yeah, yeah. The new standard tuning, I think he actually invented it, didn't he, Robert Fripp?
He did, he did.
And it was like C, G, D, A, E, G or something like that. So,
sounds,
you know, the
right.
Five lower strings are perfect fifths, I think, and then the two higher strings are like a minor third apart or something like that. So it's, instead of it being tuned in fourths, it's tuned differently and so on and so forth, which is a really, really interesting tuning to use.
Yep.
Really, really interesting idea, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
So the next question from Ben is, do you think it's a mistake to talk about the top 10 of the year a month before the end of the year? And you know what? He's probably got a point.
Yes and no. I mean, I tend to think that, yes, he has a pretty valid point. But, I mean, A, who releases a prog album on the 25th of December? I mean, seriously.
Nay, who releases any albums? Like, you get out of the way, you let Michael Bublé release his Christmas album, it dominates the charts, you come back again in a few weeks later when it's all gone away again. This is exactly what happens. You get out of the way, you let the Christmas records come out.
Absolutely. I mean, I, for one, would actually really like to see a crazy, prog Christmas album, because it actually might make me enjoy it.
Neil Morse did one a couple of years ago. It was called the Prog World Orchestra, and it was absolute garbage.
Yeah, no, but I don't want a Jesus album, mate. I want a decent.
No. This was like prog arrangements of like standard Christmas songs, and Mike Portnoy played drums on it. So you should that'll probably tell you exactly what you needed to hear. It's like, imagine like the little drummer boy with octobans. It was dreadful.
Yeah,
trust me. I can send you a copy of it if you like, but trust me, it was dreadful. I'd much rather listen to Jordan's Christmas album.
That's totally fair. Jordan's Christmas album is actually decent. But to give you an idea of how many albums are being released in December this year, so far that we know of, from what I understand, there's about 14 or 15 being released. Most of them are being released on the 4th and the 11th.
And they're just the ones that you can know about.
Of which, by the way, one of them is the new Gavin Harrison and Antoine Fafard album, Chemical Reactions, and I reckon that's going to be sick.
Wait, what? Gavin Harrison's releasing an album?
Yeah, in December.
Cool.
Now, compare and contrast that with the month before, November, where there was 40 albums released.
It gives you some idea of where the marketing priorities lie, isn't it?
Exactly. Now, that being said, there is still some stuff that will be coming out in and around that time, but it's not really a whole big amount. The other thing as well is we need a break. So as much as I love talking to Hoggy and recording things and cutting them up and so on and so forth, I do like to spend time with my family as well, as Hoggy does with his. So, yes, it's probably a little premature to do it like a month out, but you know what? I mean, we could probably record the album of the year 3 months out and just release it on the date, and it's not going to make much difference, frankly.
The other thing we could do is just do it like, January of the first, like the first podcast of 2021 is looking back at the year before.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, we could definitely do that as well. But it's definitely thought. So, thanks for asking. about that.
The other idea that Ben had was, have you thought about doing a video for the end of year, like doing it as a video?
No, because end of year videos always wind up with me having 14 beers and you having 14 beers, and it's just like yelling about things. Now, here's another one that we got on here, and I want to ask you this specifically. What are your thoughts on nu metal?
I'm assuming by nu metal we're talking about bands like Linkin Park and Limp Bizkit.
I think if you're not wearing a red cap backwards and saying, yeah, and having like chains, yeah, you're not nu metal. That's my
opinion. Well, the fun thing about nu metal is like they were the first guys to take on the 7-string guitars. And the general ethos at the time was like, 7 strings? Nah, you can't do that. That's for like shredders and guys like Marty Friedman and stuff. Mm. And then later on, when the next generation of 7-string guitar players came around, they said, oh no, we don't want to do 7-string. That's too like nu metal. So it's funny how those things sort of go in a circular thing.
I mean, new metal,
it just seemed like a product of its time, really. It was like the combination, like rap was starting to become into like really proper mainstream. And then rock bands started to incorporate like rap into rock. It just kind of makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? You cannot deny the impact that it had on the scene. I mean, Linkin Park, Korn, Limp Bizkit, all those guys, they had a huge effect on me alone. You know what I mean? Like Linkin Park was the gateway drug to metal, let's be really honest. And I think most people who are around my age who are listening to this, they would be the same. You know, and just the whole idea that they were actually able to grow out of that whole nu metal thing. But I will tell you now, one of the best live shows I've ever seen is Limp Bizkit. They're amazing live. I don't care what anyone says. Everyone's going to look at me like I'm some sort of a fucking weirdo, but I don't care. That's genuinely, genuinely one of the best live shows I've ever seen. I think I like nu metal, and it's always good to go back and have a listen to the old nu metal stuff. But then again, I'm the person as well who doesn't mind listening to Nickelback. So, you know, and I will asterisk that and say anyone who actually genuinely hates Nickelback, you're a liar, because no one genuinely hates Nickelback. They're just fun to hate. So it's a bit like
Shakespeare. No one actually likes Shakespeare. They just pretend to. So in the same way, no one actually hates Nickelback. They just pretend to, because it's kind of like the fun punching bag of the rock world.
Mm. Absolutely.
So our next question here is, what do you think about bands who made radical transformations several albums in? Well, for me, this is a very easy question to answer. It's like Marillion did it. It was awesome. And they've done it again several times through their career, where they just like throw the old sort of sounds out the window and then completely change it.
So my question is to that, and I agree with you, by the way, how many albums in, and are you talking like, are these guys talking, you know, the question is it specific albums or is it like years into their career? Right. And the reason I ask that is because what are we? 7-8 albums in was Sergeant Pepper's. And
we're talking about the Beatles here, where it's like they went from I Want to Hold Your Hand to the White Album in 5 years.
Exactly. But I mean, when you consider that they started in 1963, well, a little bit earlier than that, really, but the first album was 63, and then they finished in 1970, right? So, I mean, a lot of that stuff and a lot of the poppy kitschy stuff was started in, you know, 63 and 64. I mean, 63, you had Please Please Me and you had With the Beatles, and then you had Hard Day's Night and Beatles for Sale in 64. You had Help in 65. Help was an instrumental, massively instrumental album, because it was the first one where they were actually starting to talk like, you know, slightly darker topics and so on. So I mean, the title track, Help. Rubber Soul was 65 as well. Then you had Revolver, and this is Rubber Soul. Revolver was where they started to get a little bit more experimental and LSD and so on and so forth. And 67 was Sgt. Pepper's. So
and then after that you had the White Album.
Yeah, and then Yellow Submarine. You didn't. That's actually not correct. Magical Mystery Tour was 67. And then the White Album, then Yellow Submarine, then Abbey Road and Let It Be. So, you know, the question is, what do you mean by a couple of albums in? Are you talking over time frame or are you talking over specific albums? But in this particular day and age where it takes a band 2 years to write an album, I actually don't mind it if they change a bit, if they mature in their tastes and so on and so forth. I think it's a bit of a travesty when you get bands that do the whole, oh, they just basically, you know, made the same album again. You know, I mean, we saw that with Dream Theater, actually, when they released A Dramatic Turn of Events, and you had all these essays going up online with people being like, oh, it's basically just images and words.
The Dramatic Turn of Events, you know what I mean? Where it was like, yeah. I mean, that also wasn't helped by the fact that Mike Portnoy basically egged them on as well, where he's like, I didn't want to say anything, but it's totally true. And I'm like, dude, you are not helping.
Yeah, I know, right? I think
you'll notice that after that, he basically has zipped his lip publicly about any Dream Theater record and hasn't said a single thing ever again.
I suspect that's because they threatened to sue the fuck out of him.
No, I just suspect he probably, you know what? He's probably like, I just don't want those headlines again, because the second he said that, it blew up and went everywhere. Mm. And I think after that, he just realized, man, I should just shut up and just not say anything anymore.
Yeah.
Like, move on. I've got my bands. I've got my projects to deal with. I don't need to get involved in like late arriving parting shots at Dream Theater anymore.
Yeah. Well, we'll move on to the next question. I think we both answered that one. Basically, it's awesome. So do it. Next question is, I sought through a bit of music looking for stuff to listen to. A lot is bad in a lot of different ways, and sometimes I don't even really understand what music they're trying to make. It makes me think we should be trying to produce less music. What are your thoughts?
I don't think we should be trying to produce less music. I think the problem is that the barrier to entry to make music now...
I think we answered this a little bit ago, actually.
I think so. The barriers to entry to make music are so low now that basically anyone can do it. You don't need a fancy studio. People can make great records from their bedroom going into a laptop. Mm. It's relatively easy to procure the necessary plugins and things to make, you know, guitar. You know, all the amplifiers and everything is all like in software now. You know, it's easy. It's never been easier to make great records from your bedroom. The problem is, and this has been identified, Stephen Wilson said this in an interview once. He said, it's now too easy to sound like your favorite band. He said he used to get it all the time. People would give him CDs or tapes when he was on the road, and he said, they'd say to him, oh, you'll like this. It sounds like Porcupine Tree. Yeah. And he's like, why would I want to listen to that? Why would I want to listen to someone who's just trying to copy me? You'd think with all the tools and the plugins and everything out there that people would be coming up with more original music and more original things, combinations of different sounds and stuff. But we don't. We have the complete opposite.
Tack on that all the stuff that I said earlier as well about, you know,
I think that's
basically
part of the problem.
No one is there to say no. They don't run it past people. They don't go, hey, what do you think of this? Because when they do, people say, oh, you know, I'm not too sure that works. And they go, fuck you, you don't know what I'm doing. You don't get it. And it's like, no, it's just shit. You know what I mean? People are way too precious about their music and such. So I don't necessarily think we should be making less music. I think people should just be honing their craft a lot more. And also, it's okay to be shit. I want to make that point as well. Everyone starts out shit, and the only way you get better is by, you know, stop. This is something that Dave Grohl actually said a little while ago on this very topic.
I was wondering when we were going to get to Dave Grohl on this question and his quote about just getting in a garage with your mates and just being shit. And then you be shit for long enough until you get good.
Well, yeah. I mean, he said, you know, it's exactly what happened with Nirvana. Three of us got together and we sucked. And then it just so happened that other people didn't think we sucked, and we still sucked, but we just sucked a bit less. And that's what happened. And people don't do that anymore. It was actually the thing he was talking about, American Idol, I think, from memory.
Yeah, he was talking about it's like, yeah, you know, people just want to go on and become like instantly famous without having to do any of the, you know, slugging it out in the lower reaches of the musical thing, like playing clubs and stuff.
Exactly. Sleeping in a van with your lead singer who's got explosive flatulence, you know what I mean? Like, it's
exactly. But the other thing as well is that, like, you think about punk music, the punk and grunge as well. They're both sort of reactions to the similar sort of thing. Punk was a reaction to the prog. Grunge was a reaction to, like, hair metal and shit. Is it's like, eventually, you play your instrument enough and you will get good. You know, there's stories of, like, Sid Vicious looking over the shoulder of Sting to figure out with what notes went with what notes when he was playing the bass. I don't know how true that story is. It's like, you know, Sid Vicious wasn't a particularly great bass player for his entire life and, you know, didn't do any of the parts of the studio and stuff. But, you know, eventually you kind of figure it out.
Absolutely. Eventually you have to, right? You put enough time into something, you just naturally get good at it. Next question we had, this is one actually a lot of people ask this question. And it was asked in a myriad of different ways, but the crux of the question is, what's a super niche genre or style that you really like? I'm just going to say music concrete and I'm going to leave it at that because I'm not going down that rabbit hole. What about you, Hoggy?
I think you may have to go down that rabbit hole slowly because I've no idea what you're talking about.
So music concrete was a style of music that came out of, I think it was France, in the 70s or thereabouts. And it's not so much about music as you would think of it with, you know, piano and a singer and all that kind of stuff. It's more about the environment and the built world. And it's sort of like Folly, but not really, because then they would do things like they would affect certain sounds and, you know, put the sound of a door closing through 155 different effects and so on and so forth, and then would make it sound really, really weird. And the more modern guys, what they do is they might, for argument's sake, take the sound of a door slamming and then stretch it out to, instead of it being, you know, 3 or 4 seconds with decay and such, it might be like 6 minutes. And then they'll drop that through a whole bunch of different synthesizers and everything and get things to sort of meld and do weird things and interact with each other and such. Really, really interesting. Mick Gordon does kind of stuff like that as well with his game and his synth stuff for video games and so on and so forth. Did a lot of it on the Doom soundtrack. So I find it intensely interesting. But the pure form of it was basically sort of like Folly and you know, soundscapes and things like that. It's really interesting, but it's certainly not for everyone.
Yeah, that does sound very niche. You've probably, I mean, the closest thing that I can come to that is over here in Western Australia, we have a surprisingly good jazz scene, which has really sort of flourished in this sort of post-COVID-19 situation we have over here in Western Australia. I don't know what it is. Maybe, like, jazz musicians are used to getting paid nothing anyway, so they have suddenly, like, flourished in this idea of people want to see live music and don't particularly want to pay a lot for it, which is, I think I said this on the episode that we did with Ben on Australian Hunger. I said that, you know, there will be like this sort of flourishment of like people wanting to go and see live gigs, absolutely. And then it'll all collapse again and go back to the way it was, which is basically what's happened now. I mean, here we are. Some states aren't even out of it and we're already kind of like, quote unquote, back to normal. So, I mean, that's the closest thing that I have an answer to this is like, super like a niche genre is like, you know, quite getting into the jazz that goes on here in this state, which is some of it is really interesting and can be quite technical. So we have a couple of questions here from the guys over at Drop That Stylus. The first question is, what impact has Aussie music made to the industry? I mean, the impact that I think we've said this before. It's like when any Australian musician gets any tiny bit of notoriety in this country, they just leave and end up in America or end up in England.
Yeah, absolutely. I think their impact over there can't be understated. I mean, sure, we could talk about AC/DC, right? But go back before them. Well, probably not before them, actually. Maybe a little bit after. Might be getting my timeline skewed. But if you look at the Little River Band, right? The Little River Band, and this is a quote from a DJ over there, and I've said this before on the show, but they paved the highway for other Australian acts to follow. You know, if we didn't have the Little River Band, we wouldn't have AC/DC. We wouldn't have INXS. We wouldn't, or at least not a successful form of those people.
Yeah, you wouldn't have Cult Chisel. You wouldn't have Jimmy mm-hmm. Barnes. You wouldn't yes. have those kind of guys.
Absolutely.
Which kind of follows on to our next question, which came from Matt as well, which was, what's some of your go-to Aussie 80s bands besides AC/DC?
I mean, Little River Band, for one. they're yep. a big one of mine. What about you? I'm just trying to think. Oh, Midnight Oil, always.
Yeah, I was going to say Midnight Oil's. The other one as well that I was going to call out was Hunters and Collectors.
Oh yeah.
I really like Mark Seymour's songwriting. I think he's an excellent songwriter. The one that we like to claim as our own, even though they're totally not actually Australians, would be Crowded House, which is the obvious one. Crowded House, Split Enz, you know, the Finn Brothers, even though they're Kiwis, we still like to claim them as our own.
Yeah, anything by the Finn Brothers. Goanna as well. They're absolutely fantastic. Not just for that only one song that they do, but for some of their other stuff as well.
I'm not exactly sure whether you would describe it as an 80s band, but, you know, bands like Yothu Yindi as well.
Well, Yothu Yindi's Treaty was, that was 91, wasn't it? But yes.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not exactly 80s, but Yothu Yindi, and then, you know, Archie Roach as well is another, you know, fantastic Australian singer-songwriter.
Yeah, Paul Kelly.
Yeah.
Like, you talk about prolific Australian songwriters. There's one.
Yep. Absolutely. You know,
and I mean, if you want to sort of put this into context with the first question as well, I mean, I know we do a lot of shitting on the Australian music industry on this show, but the bands that actually do it and do it well, are they ever going to be as big as Metallica or, you know, Michael Jackson or anything like that? Probably not. But I tell you what, and I hate this phrase when you're talking about Australia, but it always comes up because it's so fucking true. We punch well above our weight on an international stage. I mean, you look at arguably the two biggest metalcore acts in the world right now, and the whole metalcore scene actually is a thing. Parkway Drive and Polaris. One of them's from the Central Coast. The other one is from Sydney. We do metalcore better than any other country on the earth. No idea why. I don't know what it is we have to be so angry about, but, you know, that's really well. We do psych extremely well as well, like psych rock and all that sort of stuff. I mean, you know, you've got Tame Impala, King Gizzard and Lizard Wizard, as we were talking about before. Pond as well. Jesus, who else? So many. And we are really on the forefront of the whole psych thing as well. For some reason, it's come back around again, and, you know, it's now a thing again. But, you know, you're right. INXS are in there as well. I mean, far out. John Butler from the John Butler Trio. I mean, Wolfmother had a thing there for a while.
Yeah, just assumed that Wolfmother were like a Led Zeppelin ripoff, which I always thought was the laziest, which I thought was the laziest comparison in the world.
Closure in Moscow, Kingswood, the DZ Death Rays. I mean, Panal, the Presets. I mean, start talking electro music now. You know, the Presets. I mean, one of the biggest electro house outfits in like 2005 to 2009, and they were from Newtown here in Sydney, you know. I think it's probably less a case of what impact have we had on the industry, but the impact that we have when we have an impact, and it's huge. Like, there's stuff that, you know, the Little River Band, for example, and I keep coming back to them, but they had a very unique sound and they were massive, absolutely massive. So, you know, it's, I just think it's really, really interesting. And I think as Australians, we should be actually really proud of our industry, which is why we get so angry, going back to the first question, about why the industry, how the industry treats its artists and how this country treats its artists. And it's just awful.
The bit that, I mean, the problem with the scene is itself is all of these bands that we've spoken about, INXS, Mid.org, Cold Chisel, blah, 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 all came up through like the pub rock scene. They all were pub bands and that style of music. And where in Australia do we have these places where it, we don't? We just don't. We don't have pub rock anymore. We don't have pubs putting on bands as much these days. It just doesn't exist.
Exactly.
It's all like ridiculous idiots with headphones on playing music they didn't write.
That's exactly it.
In nightclubs.
That's exactly it. And or it's two guys, two half-drunk, balding, middle-aged men sitting on a stool, both playing Maiden acoustic guitars and doing covers. That's it.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just, anyway, it's depressing, but I think we have so much more to give and we really should be investing in it a lot more than we are. The government should be investing a lot more in our arts than what they are. I'm going to move the question on, though. Friend of the show, Joshua Batten, what are your favorite albums from a production standpoint?
As much as I like to shit on what he's currently doing because I don't much like it, I think the albums that Stephen Wilson has produced are top class.
Yep, I was going to say the same thing.
So what am I looking for when I'm looking for a production? What I'm looking for is a record that hasn't been overly compressed and is therefore hilariously loud. Looking at you, Rick Rubin. And I'm also looking for a way that I can hear all the instruments. You've got guitars, keyboards, bass, and drums. Yep. I should be able to hear all of them. There are so many records out there where you just do not hear the bass at all. It's like they've all listened to Injustice for All and thought, yes, that's the way forward. We're not going to bother with this pesky bass guitar lines and out the window with that. We're just going to make it a big wall of keyboards and guitars and sod the lot of
yours. Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. As much as I can't stand his new stuff, he is a very, very good musician and he is extremely talented on the production front.
Totally.
I'm going to go a little bit further back in time for this. And I'm going to mention an album that we mentioned quite a fucking lot on this show. And that is Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah. Alan Parsons did an amazing job of that record.
But, you know, it's incredible is, and I remember when it, when they released the new version of it in like 2013, I think it was, when they released the remaster, they went back to the original recordings and remixed and remastered the entire thing. And I remember listening to it with headphones on, the MP3 version, not even like the vinyl version, but the MP3 version. And I got goosebumps. It was so completely different, the remaster and the remix and such. It just breathed new life into this thing. I can't say that that would happen with current albums.
No. I mean, the remixing of albums, that this is a whole other rabbit hole that we can disappear down one day, but I don't much care for like the remixing and remastering of old albums. I'm much happier to stick with the originals. Maybe that's just me as like someone who sort of self-described as rather a music fan. I'm not much of an audiophile, to be honest. I'm not one much. I hear these people and they talk about their 5.1 surround systems and their super high quality music and, oh, how can you possibly take anything that's like a 320 kilobits per second MP3? That's garbage. You got to have like the full bit rate. And I'm just like, dude,
because
you are completely full of shit.
Because you can't hear the fucking difference.
Exactly.
Like these,
you are
I'm
completely
so sorry.
Full of shit.
And I'm sorry if these are any of your friends and if there are people listening to this who are audio wankers running around saying, oh, I only listen to music in FLAC. Why? Do you like only having half an album on your phone? Are you retarded? Like you cannot hear and discern the difference between a 320 VBR piece of
music.
Not when
you're playing it through a phone.
And a FLAC piece of music and anything else that has been recorded, and I'm going to asterisk this, but anything that has been recorded basically post about 1985 to 1990, somewhere around there, and onward, you cannot tell the goddamn difference. And even if you could, and if the, it's, no, I'm sorry, you can't do it. It is ridiculous. And it's massively placebo effect. I mean, these people that run around and spend, you know, $2,500, $3,000 on a pair of headphones, of course something's going to sound. You could get the sound of Donald Trump farting and wanking at the same time. It would sound good on a pair of headphones like that. You know, like, seriously. And these people go around and go, oh, it's all because of the audio input. No, it's not. You've just made yourself a pair of German-made freaking handcrafted things that are tuned to your eardrums. Of course it's going to sound good, you dickhead. You know, it's just, again, this is the kind of shit that we get angry about. It's not the music itself. It's the morons in the industry.
And also the leveraging of said idiocy for pure profit. It's like, we could sell the thing for like five times more and say that it's like at this higher bit rate that nobody can hear the difference of, because it's like, and we can sell it for like twice the price. And yeah.
Tell me about it. I mean, I know someone who's looking at getting hearing aids at the moment, right? And they were asking me because, oh, you're in audio, you're in music, you'd know what good ones are. I'm like, oh, really? Anyway, they were looking at these ones and they were about 12 or 15 grand or something for these ear...
what?
I keep saying, going to say earphones, but for you know, or hearing aids.
$15,000?
Yeah. And meantime, I'm sitting there with my and they had to have the thing and goes over the back of the ear and all that kind of stuff and everything like that. Meantime, I'm sitting there with my pair of $300 Sennheisers, $300 Samsungs, going, I cannot see an, you know, $14,700 difference here. This is ridiculous. And it's seriously exactly what you just said. It's profit. That's all it is. It's just profit making. And it's even worse when it's, you know, particularly people who are vulnerable, people who have lost their hearing, people who are, you know, a bit older and so on and so forth. And it's just I find that stuff vile. I really do. You know, it just doesn't make any sense to me. But anyway. Yeah.
We're miles away from the question.
We are miles away. We never digress on this
production. No, not at all. The other producer I was going to call out as well is, I particularly like Mike Hunter's production on the Merillion albums. I don't know why, but he seems to get a bit of knocking from the Merillion fan base. I don't know why. Maybe somebody can write in and tell me why, because I can't really tell the difference. I think he does a really good job.
I can
with
tell
the
you the answer to that.
Records,
they're listening to it in 320 VBR on MP3. They're not listening to it in FLAC. That's why.
I think he did a better production job than Dave Megan did, and boy, that's a controversial opinion about the Merillion fan base.
Jesus, tell me about it.
Anyway, we're going to wrap up our Q&A section here with a couple of Dream Theater related questions, because of course we put out a call out in the Dream Theater Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand for some questions, and we have a question here from Dave Harwood that says, do you think Dream Theater's current musical direction is a bit samey? Do you think they need to change it up?
I'm going to answer this one in one very simple word. Yes. Next.
But they never will. They won't.
No, they won't.
They just won't.
I don't think they will.
They clearly, look, they clearly demonstrated this 10 years ago with their pick of drummer. They had an opportunity to get somebody like a Marco Miniman or Aquilus Priester into the band. And they didn't. They turned them all down for an East Coast drummer named Mike. You know, that was like...
To be fair, of the people that they auditioned, Mike Mangini was the best pick. He gelled the best, etc., right? That being said, the close find after him was Marco Miniman. Like...
And here's the problem. Marco Miniman has admitted in interviews that he didn't really want to join the band. He just was there for the audition. He was like, oh, this would be fun. I've worked with James before. I know the guys. We've been around in the same places. Yeah. This sounds like a bit of fun.
Mm.
I don't think he really wanted to join the band.
That's a real shame.
I think he was
more
interested in, like, doing his own projects and, like, doing the solo stuff. And
although I understand that from a musician's point of view, but that's such a shame. Not that I don't like Mangini. Yeah, I love Mangini. I love the stuff he does, much akin, despite the fact that there's always people that are, oh, Portnoy's better, or oh, Mike's better, or I don't give a fuck, you know. But yes, I think still think they need to change it up.
I think that was part of the problem as well. Yeah, but they won't. They've got their sound. They've got their style. They like the way that they do things now. That's it. But what I was going to say as well is, like, in amongst all those other drummers they could have picked, like, Virgil Donati basically said the same thing in a Q&A when I saw him do a drum clinic here in Perth. He was like, it was a fun gig. Mike Mangini was the best pick for the band, and I would have been a terrible fit.
Yeah, no, I agree.
He admitted it.
I agree.
I think he said, "How can a man with matched grip play in a metal band?" I think was his sort of one word, his sort of one line joke answer to the question.
No, I agree. So the final question that we've got here this evening is from Steve James. And thank you to everyone who's been sending questions in. We had to obviously pick a few. We couldn't pick everyone's. But thank you for doing that. And if we do it again, we will do more questions. Top three Petrucci solos. Not a fair question, but I'm going to ask you first.
Yeah, trying to pick three was a bit tricky. So I'm going to pick... I'm going to pick one of each of his styles. So we've got the melodic solos, we've got the straight-out shred solos, and then we've just got like his technical WTF solos, I'm going to call them. So out of the melodic ones, I keep going back to The Spirit Carries On. I think that is a great solo.
Absolutely.
That sort of blend between John Petrucci and like the sort of David Gilmour, Steve Rothery kind of sound. He nailed it on that one. Mm. So that's that one. The balls out shreddy solos. People might expect me to pick The Glass Prison. I'm not going to. I'm going to pick As I Am.
Yes.
I think that's a really good solo. And the other one that I'm going to pick is the one that John Petrucci says is his favorite solo, which is Under a Glass Moon, which is like, basically he describes that as his like bag of tricks solo because you've got the alternate picking, you've got the sweep picking, you've got tapping in there, you've got like pinch harmonics. There's all sorts of other, you know, it's like it's just basically his grab bag of guitar tricks for that solo. Those are my three. Now I'm going to throw it over to the guitar player in the audience and you can tell me your three.
I'm going to do the exact same thing. I'm going to choose the three, you know, a weird sort of solo and then a shreddy balls to the wall solo and then a melodic solo. And I'm going to give you the specific versions of this. Now, a lot of people, when I say specific versions, a lot of people are going to go melodic solo, Hollow Years, Live at Budokan, obviously. No. I mean, yes, unbelievable solo. However, not the best one, in my opinion. The best one, in my opinion, is Once in a Lifetime's version of Lines in the Sand. That is an amazing solo.
See, here's the thing. I framed the question only in the fact of the studio recordings. You're going to pick for the live recordings.
Well, I'm just, you know, I decided to, you know, guitar nerd it up a little bit. So that's the melodic one. Straight out balls to the wall shred fest solo. I'm probably going to. I was almost gonna say As I Am, like almost so close to saying that. However, I think I'm gonna have to go with the Blind Faith solo.
Specifically
the unison solo with him and Rudess, because that shit's ridiculous. Unbelievably, A, quick, and B, shreddy, and very dream theater. So have to go with that one. As for the weird and wonderful solo, I'm going to have to go with another one of 6 Degrees of Inner Turbulence, and that is the solo from Misunderstood.
I was wondering if this was, if I was just thinking of this one as well, and I was like, damn it, I should have said that one, but you picked the one that I wanted to pick. I was just thinking about it. I was like, damn, I should have picked
that
one. I just
love the way that he did it.
Yes. You know,
by actually recording it forward and then reversing it and then learning it reversed and then recording it forward and then playing that into a reverse delay and then learning that backwards again and then playing that. So it's just this whole weird.
Was it that? I thought it was. I thought he learned it forward, then learned it backwards, and then played it backwards, and then they just flipped the tape over again. So it sounds like it was forwards, but it the, could the have notes been. Have got that
genuinely,
twist to
I can't
it.
Remember. It's some ridiculous thing, anyway.
Well, herein lies the problem. Herein lies the problem. John Petrucci was asked about this on a Wikipedia Fact or Fiction YouTube video. Even he couldn't remember how he did it. So this is probably one of those things that you're just going to have to like get Mike Portnoy on a good day and ask him, because I guarantee you he'll know where how it was done. But, you know, asking him Dream Theater questions these days is, I don't know. I don't know if you get the same result out of him these days.
Mm, I tend to agree with you. Yeah, so there you go. So that's the end of the Q&A. And I think it's a good way to do the Q&A as well, coming toward the tail end of what has been an atrocious year, I think, for everyone. So, yeah, it was really good to do that. We will do that at another point in the future, I think.
So the album that I gave you, Dave, was an album by a band called Pixie Ninja. The album was called Colors Out of Space. What'd you think?
I thought it was really interesting. Kind of had this weird industrial vibe with traditional instruments and non-traditional instruments sort of scattered through. Pretty sure I heard a melodyne and a theremin in there somewhere, as well as, you know, typical sorts of drums and bass guitar and, you know, overdriven stuff. It was really, really cool. I was about 3/4 of the way through it, and I was like, this reminds me of something, and I can't think of, oh my God, it sounds like the music from Perfect Dark. And I was immediately happy about that and went back and listened. And it is really, really similar to a lot of the stuff from the Perfect Dark video game, in the orchestration and the construction of it and so on and so forth. Really, really interesting. Definitely one to recommend. Can't say I'd have it on at a party as background music, but it's good for a little bit of private listening. Now, Hoggy, I gave you one by Great Wide Nothing. The album was called Hymns for Hungry Spirits, Volume 1. What'd you think?
My initial thought when I fired up this record and it kicked in with the drums, bass, and the Hammond organ, I thought, good morning, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Glad you could join us. I mean, that was unmistakable combination of bass sounds, Hammond organ, and drums without any guitars is so ELP, it's not even funny. There are definitely elements of, like, Yes and Genesis and Spock's Beard, who are definitely influenced themselves by Genesis. It's hard to get away from referencing the classics, though, when you're using those very classic synth sounds and those keyboard sounds straight out of the box. If I had a criticism of the record, it's using those out of the box synthesizers, I think, dates it a little bit. But on the other hand, I understand that programming synth sounds and developing those is literally a full-time job. And comparing these guys to, like, Jordan Rudess, Rick Wakeman, Mark Kelly is rather unfair. So, I mean, it's not a straight rip-off of, like, classic prog sounds, though. And the vocals are very unique, with a definite sort of mid-Atlantic quality. It sort of sounds, you know, it's a bit of like there's American influences there, there's British influences there. So overall, it's if you like
that kind
of prog music, this is a very nice record to get into, I think. So the record that I have for you this week, Dave, is actually by an Australian progressive metal band. This album has managed to slide under our radar. I don't know how the hell we managed to do that. But it's by Terra Maze, and the album is called I Wonder. Check it out.
Fantastic. I will give that an absolute spin. Oops. Now, the album that I have for you is also a brand new prog album released this year. Actually, only released about 2 weeks ago at time of recording. Brand new Kepler 10 album, A New Kind of Sideways. Check it out and let me know what you think.
Alrighty, will do. So I think that about wraps it up for this week here it on the 9-8 podcast. If you'd like to find the show notes for this week's episode, you can find them at the 98podcast.fireside.fm/66. See, I actually wrote it down this time. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM, and you can also find us at Facebook at facebook.com/98FM. If you'd like to send us a contact, send us an email, you could do so on our website at the 98podcast.fireside.fm/contact.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for listening along tonight. We'll see you all again in a fortnight's time, unless you have anything else you'd like to add along, Dave.
No, I think, but if we are seeing these wonderful, lovely people in about a fortnight's time, then these two albums are going to be the two last albums of the year. And it means that our very next episode is going to be our last one for the year, which we are going to be going through our top 10 albums of the year. Now, Hoggy and I both have our own individual lists. And if you are on our Patreon, you are going to get exclusive access to our top 10 lists the day before the episode goes live. So if you are one of our Patreon subscribers who help us go a little bit of the way to keeping the show on the air every week, then you are going to be getting a bit of a sneak preview. Obviously, the only thing is we'd ask you not to share it for those who want to wait and not look at those things. But until next time, thank you very much for listening. My name's Dave Ellis.
My name is Alex Hogg. Thank you very much. We'll see you all next time.